Hello, and welcome to episode 69 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
And Chris Lay, Lee's podcast operation manager, will be our special guest for the next 2 weeks. Very special indeed. Next week, the three of us will make predictions about what to expect in the new year. But today, we will look back on what we said 1 year ago and find out how accurate those prognostications were. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Between the three of us, we made 9 predictions for 2022, some good and, well, some not so good. But that's a lot to get through, so let's get right to it, and I'll begin. I said 1 year ago that real progress will be made in developing what science called the dream vaccine. That's a single shot that protects against all coronaviruses. But I also added that won't stop a vocal minority from getting inoculated. I'm afraid that prediction, at least the first part of it, was a bit too optimistic, although there has been some progress made around a single shot to protect against all coronaviruses. A lot of the funding for that has not happened yet, and without public funding, it seems like the brakes have been put on that a little bit, and I'll be curious to hear what the both of you think, but certainly, COVID is not as big of a story as it was the past 2 years, but certainly was part of the conversation. I think many, if not most of us, knew someone who had it at least once this past year. And I guess what frustrates me is that we get into all these debates about that we've been really having since the beginning of this around masking and other things, when I think we should really be spending a lot more time talking about things that are more long-term solutions, whether it's better and stronger vaccines, whether it's things like increasing ventilation and things that we know are going to work and be good for the long run.
Hey, Scott, I just wanted to ask you, because I know with a lot of these bioengineering projects involving whether it's new vaccines or, many of the work that's being done on genetically based cures for cancer, there's a pretty good idea of how to do it. It's a matter of making it to scale, so it's both affordable and practical to deliver to enough people to really be worthwhile. And it seems to me the dream vaccine one, though, there's not really a clear idea of how even to do it. Is that right?
I mean, it's a little over my expertise level, but from what I have read, I mean, they're still looking at figuring that out. And, frankly, I think when COVID first hit, we were all holding out hope that there would be some vaccine. A lot of our healthcare officials said, no, this is going to take a long, long time. And, I don't think it was entirely because of his pressure, but I think certainly partially because of his pressure. Former President Donald Trump initiated Project Warp Speed, which was a silly name for a really important process. And it really did sort of take out some of the red tape and really move this along. Now, of course, many years later, or a few years later at least, it's sort of odd that the party that is associated with Donald Trump is about the least interested in finding new vaccines. But I'm convinced that if there was another push like a Project Warp Speed, that we could move this along more quickly than we already have.
Yeah, I just don't know. I wish I knew more about the kind of research that is going on with viruses and kind of the new mRNA technology to know whether the roadblock is in the nature of viruses itself and their mutations. And if there's, hope that they might find a pathway to developing more something of a universal vaccine, or if there's not really if there's just a hope but not really a clear idea of how even to do it yet.
Yeah, and I think it's probably somewhere in the middle, but I do know that, and I'm checking on a story from, it's about a month old now, and obviously we're still going in through some funding bills at the end of the congressional year, but at that point, there was even some pushback from Republicans in November, at least. At that time, Republicans in the Senate were holding back $5 billion. And I think that would help fund this and other projects. And I think, you know, seeing how few Americans have taken the latest vaccine, which is supposed to offer better protection against the current variants, I mean, I also worry that even if this were developed next week, it's not going to be next week, but if it were available next week, how many people would be that eager to get it? It doesn't seem like the celebratory nature of when vaccines first came out sort of seems like a distant memory.
$5 billion, that's, I mean, you could build a football stadium in LA for that.
Well, we have a lot of things to get to in today's prediction list. I'll put that one down as mostly not true on my first one. Chris, however, I think did a little better with one of his predictions.
Maybe too good. my first prediction up was that the market for NFTs will crater. And instead of NFTs being the thing that cratered, it's basically the entire Bitcoin market. So, and while those are obviously not the same thing, I mean, I've pulled up CoinDesk right now, and a year ago, you know, one Bitcoin was about 45, and it's lost, you know, 2/3 of that. It's down to like 15 now. I mean, it's been a really, really rough few months, if not the full year of 2022 for Bitcoin. And that's even before we even talk about all of the Bankman-Fried, everything that's going on with that. So, which is still unfolding in its way. So yeah, did not expect it to go. I mean, you know, the Bored Ape Yacht Club is as goofy as it was back then, but now just much less valuably so.
My grandpa used to always give me investment advice. He'd say, now remember, this could always go to zero. Do you think there's a possibility? Because right now, isn't it, aren't most of the cryptocurrencies trading about where they were, say, about 3 years ago? Like there was a sharp rise and then a sharp decline, right?
That sounds about right. Yeah. And a lot of the sharp rise is, you know, definitely lined up with the pandemic and also the rolling out of a lot, you know, these apps that made it easier to trade Bitcoin. I like the idea of the people that are trading the Bitcoin are going to be the losers. And it's the, you know, what is it? The only one who makes the most money in a gold rush are the people selling the shovels. And that's the, you know, that's the position that you want to be in for something like this. So that's, I've neither bought nor sold Bitcoins myself. It seemed way too flexible and, you know, in flux as far as any kind of financial thing, but it's almost maybe better that it didn't end up establishing itself. And I mean, there's still a future for it, I'm sure. Anything on the blockchain is, but without it losing as much steam as it did, it could have become the sort of thing that would have caused a lot more problems when it actually did, you know, fall out. And with NFTs, we'll end up coming back to that when I start talking about some of the, you know, political aspirations of folks out there and recent NFTs in the news. So we'll circle back to that.
You took away one of my questions, so we'll get to that later. But I have a question for Rick about an ethical end of this. You know, I'm going to stereotype here a bit, but in some ways it's true, is that you have a lot of sort of these young, sometimes jerky seeming, mostly white guys who were all in on crypto and NFTs and acting like they understood this tremendously complicated scheme and were just, you know, in some cases making ridiculous amounts of money. I read in Miami, for example, where a lot of this is going on, is that when this fell apart, the Miami economy took a bit of a hit, especially in places where people like to very ostentatiously show off their wealth. But I guess the question for Rick is, I think some people were like, you know, it felt different to people than like if like the stock market took a 30% correction, or when the housing market fell like it did 10, 15 years ago, that this affected some people that were a little more difficult to like. And should that matter in a way, that about how we react to this? I mean, you know, versus people losing their houses when the housing market dried up in 2008 and 2009, should we feel like less bad because this was sort of a questionable scheme from the start?
I think so. I mean, I feel less bad about it. I mean, the whole thing has seemed to me from the beginning to be a Ponzi scheme, because I could never get straight answers. What does cryptocurrency actually produce? Like, what's it based on? And the answer is, well, nothing except, you know, people's confidence, but it's unregulated. That's a
red design.
Yeah, by design, right? That's a red flag. And then, you know, then the people, I mean, personalities like Sam Bankman-Fried who are, you know, flouting any kind of the sorts of conventions that I guess would be predictive of a personality and organizations that have some kind of self-regulation or self-control, you know, and then, so then you're trusting them, you're investing in them. That, I mean, it's hard for me to have too much sympathy for people who invested a lot. Now, I know quite a few people who invested small, you know, like 5 or 10%, you know, like testing it out. And, you know, and sometimes that was quite a bit of money, but, you know, but they were putting in what they could spare to lose. I think it was for those, you know, who lost a great amount of their personal wealth, you know, it seemed to me to be a pretty foolish bargain.
Rick, what was your prediction? One of your three predictions from our show last year.
I predicted that in 2022 storms would be much worse and that insurance rates would rise significantly because of that. And I'm going to rate that as partially true and partially false. We didn't have as many hurricanes in 2022 as we had the last few years, but they were more destructive. Hurricane Ian was the deadliest and the costliest storm since Hurricane Katrina in 2005. So that and you know that came late in the year, but insurance losses are reported to be about $67 billion for that storm alone, which is a huge amount. And I was just looking today, insured losses from storms around the world last year were $115 billion compared to a 10-year average of $80 billion. And you know, part of that is that an increasing population. And so the same storm today as 20 years ago will cause a lot more damage because, you know, the values of property values are more. But it's also that we've had a few storms the past year that were especially bad.
And I think I remember saying on the show last year that it's things like that where there are real bottom line implications to people's pocketbook, where, you know, there's a dramatic increase in insurance premiums, for example, is sometimes what it takes to get people to pay attention to issues like climate change. And you wonder, and if this is part of it, and you also wonder when some really smart people working at these insurance companies trying to figure out the risks involved in these policies is really looking more closely at certain regions and making adjustments appropriately.
I learned something really fascinating. I had always assumed that, you know, when we have these huge storms that where insurance companies are paying out those billions of dollars for the damages, that most of that money is going to the people who suffered the damage, but it's not. By far the biggest drivers of insurance cost increases are fraud and litigation.
Really?
And there's a really much higher rates of fraud and litigation following a storm, because you have all these, you know, con artists, scam artists coming into those areas, like into Florida in the wake of a really big storm. And then there's a lot of lawsuits, and those cases make their way to courts. And so it takes years and years really for those costs to get averaged out.
We all should have been attorneys, I think, Rick.
Yep. They're the ones profiting from the storms.
Well, moving on to my second prediction I made a year ago for 2022, I said the scarcity for employees will only deepen, and as often happens, big companies will find ways to outcompete smaller firms, and that happy employees will be looked at as one of the leading indicators of a business's success. I guess I would mark this again. I think like a lot of these might be is partially true. The employment market is still pretty strong if you're looking for work. There has been a lot of attention as of late in the high tech world. And in, frankly, sometimes in the media world, we've seen some news out of places like CNN and, of course, Twitter and Facebook and places like that. But let's remember that that's not by any stretch where most of Americans have their jobs and where they work. The markets or the job market for people in most sectors is still pretty strong. A lot of that has to do with an aging population and demographics behind that. But I think in many cases, there are employers who are really still struggling to find workers. And I think what I said last year still rings true, where it is oftentimes these smaller organizations or small businesses that have a tougher time attracting people. For example, the town in which Rick and I live is a town of about, probably a metro of about 100,000 people. And a very, very large grocery store opened up here. And they, I think the news story said several hundred people. And they had no problem. I shouldn't say, I don't know if they had no problem, but they were able to open the store with several hundred people. And I think because they could offer benefits and they could offer other perks and maybe even a higher wage. And a lot, I'm sure a lot of smaller businesses in our community probably lost some good employees to places like that. And I think that is just a small example of what is still probably happening across this country.
I still run across a number of small businesses who have not had trouble retaining their employees because they treat them so well. They've created really good culture and kind of a family atmosphere. And I think the ones that have done that really well, they're not having a problem.
And you think that my statement of happy employees will be looked at as one of the leading indicators of a business's success. It sounds like in many cases, that's still the case.
Yeah. And if anything, organizations like Gallup, for example, that are really working hard on this, like issues of employee engagement and trying to figure out, like, how do you build a culture that makes your employees feel welcome and also be protected from the rude behavior of customers, which is increasing. The companies that do that sort of thing really well, they're seeing the benefits of it.
Chris, your second prediction from last year was in the entertainment world.
It was indeed. And my prediction was that Louis C.K. was going to pioneer a lane for quote unquote canceled entertainers to model their comebacks on. And I'm going to say that that's like 50-50 in that I don't think that he has shown something that is replicatable necessarily, but I think that he's certainly come back. He won a Grammy last year. He put out a movie called The 4th of July, which you can buy on his website if you feel so inclined. And 14 of the 16 upcoming concert dates that he's got, including a stop at Madison Square Garden, are all sold out. So, I have a lot of friends who are very much involved in, you know, local stand-up comedy or other genres or, you know, some, you know, levels of involvement and appreciation, and people that have, you know, real clear-cut opinions on comedians they like, and none of them have given anything that Louis C.K. has put out the time of day. And these are people who, you know, four or five years ago, whatever, would have, you know, been clamoring for any of this stuff. I've seen him in concert twice before, you know, the actual, you know, accusations came out from him and came out about him and were pretty quickly, you know, validated. And everyone that I know has pretty much dropped him as anyone that they care about. comedically. So I don't know who the audience is that's going to these things and seeing the movie that he put out, and he's also nominated for a Grammy that will be announced coming up, and that's on that same list of folks who are nominated for the Grammy for Best Comedy Album is Dave Chappelle, which is a whole other kettle of fish. He's not exactly canceled, the means by which he is making his living now are the way that he's dodged as much, current day criticism it's not something that can easily be assumed by somebody else who's not Louis C.K.
Do you think that it is actually Dave Chappelle who defined that lane or created a pathway that other comedians might follow better, or don't you?
I don't know. I mean, the whole thing with Chappelle is that he has this huge platform of Netflix where he signed this, I don't know, it was hundreds of millions of dollars, however much, for Netflix to put out, I think, 4 or 5 specials of his, which I think they have done at this point. So I don't know what the re-upping of that contract is going to look like, but Netflix doesn't have any input on what he does. So he can just kind of do whatever he's doing. And I mean, obviously the most recent thing was him bringing out Elon Musk, to which Elon Musk was booed passionately by the crowd. Maybe that's a good thing that we got to see that happen. But,
and there's a difference too, that Chappelle kind of seeks out controversial content,
yes,
for his shows. Whereas yes, Louis C.K. he was canceled for his personal conduct.
Yeah. Yeah. Louis C.K. was, and there's, worlds of difference between having, opinions or thoughts or, outlook on marginalized people in the way that Dave Chappelle has towards, trans men and women. But yeah, it's what Louis C.K. was doing was, outright sexual assault. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts on that. And it still is something where, I can't get over the Louis C.K.'s, apology letter about that just never included the word sorry. Like, there was just no, the barest admission of any kind of guilt. And there's a much larger conversation to be had about the way to come back from being canceled. The word canceled is just so fraught at this point. It carries so many different things. But the idea of somebody looking for, to regain some place as an entertainer in that industry without publicly wrestling with the actions they had, the implications that there were, and the effect that it had on the victims. And you're at a point now where if you are a big enough planet and have that large enough amount of, I guess, gravity or momentum, then you can just kind of disappear and go live in France for a few years and then come back, and enough people will validate you to just carry on with what you're doing. And yeah, that's his thing now. Yeah.
And setting, just to kind of close on this one for just a second, but setting Louis C.K. aside for just a second, do you think that there is any difference today than a year ago in the propensity for people in the entertainment world, or I guess more broadly, just public figures, to be canceled? Either of you think that has changed at all in the past 12 months?
My knee jerk is that it seems like there's been the idea of canceling, where it's, someone, you have enough people that say, oh, that was a bad thing that you did, versus something like Harvey Weinstein, where that's not just being canceled. It seems like things are getting split into levels of cancellation and the reasons why people were canceled. And if it gets to the point where there's a legal case to be made, we're looking at a year that saw not only, Harvey Weinstein, but also R. Kelly. And a lot of these things that had been open secrets in both of those respective entertainment industries. And, that's the below that is a lot of, you know, people rightfully, but, you know, squabbling over more semantics issues, I think, of the term cancellation and what power that has.
It seems to me like there's been a real shift. Public responses to what are perceived as social violations are a little bit more nuanced, a little more proportionate to the perceived offense than they were at one time. So, and I hope that continues.
Well, continuing on our list today, Rick, you had a prediction that I think we can safely mark as true.
Yeah, and it's so true that it seems just obvious. Like, how could it have even been a prediction? I what I said was that mask mandates would end, and because they ended so quickly after that, between mid-February and mid-March, pretty much all the states in the country had ended their mask mandate. So it was just one after another. But at the time in December, we were still talking about, you know, the possibility of new severe variants that might arise and create even a worse pandemic, and still talking about the effectiveness of vaccines. And so it was still a live debate. And I really thought that that the mask mandates would end, but they would kind of gradually go from one state to another. But, you know, by the end of March, pretty much all the states had ended their mandates. And then in April, a federal judge ended the public transportation mandate. And so that pretty much did it. And we didn't see too many masks around in public spaces except healthcare settings after that.
It was interesting. You mentioned that federal court ruling in April, and we were on vacation during that, and we flew out during the mask mandate. So, of course, we and everybody else on the plane wore a mask. And I think it was 2 or 3 days after we got to Southern California, there was the news. And I remember thinking, gosh, it'll be really interesting, I said to somebody where we were staying, about how many people will be masked on the way back. And this person tried to convince me that, no, it won't be interesting at all. Nobody will be wearing a mask. And I'm like, no, that's not true. It'll be like 50-50 or close to that. Well, no, at least on the one flight that we were on, it was probably 85% weren't wearing a mask. And this was just like 2 or 3 days after the mandate was lifted. So I think people were certainly, and again, my firm stance on masks is, please, at this point, do what you think's best. I also don't think for a minute we should ever shame anyone who does decide to wear a mask. They could have all sorts of reasons that they're wearing one that we don't know about. And I think that's fine. And they should be able to do that and probably should be doing it if that's what they decide. But yeah, to say mask them, and we've had a few small spikes in COVID. Maybe right now we could be in the middle of one of them. There have been some chatter in distant places about reinstituting this, you know, whether in schools or public places or all sorts of things. But I think the appetite for that, unless we get to a really bad place again, is pretty small.
I will say airplanes have always mystified me. Even at the beginning, I still, the, you know, handful of however many times that I've been on an airplane since the pandemic, it's the, you know, you're in such a tight space, breathing the same air with such a wide swath of people that you don't know. You don't know where they've been. You don't know anything about them. And then you got the mask on, and then a lady comes by, or you know, a steward person, you know, comes and brings, you know, stuff for you to take your mask off and then eat and drink. It's a, like, I don't understand the, it seemed like that was the very clear fatal flaw in that entire operation. But
and people airplanes. And people said that, you know, when you're actually seated in your seat, and that even I think before COVID airlines had pretty good ventilation, I think they upgraded it accordingly, that actually when you're sitting in your seat, you're actually in pretty, you know, in pretty good condition to avoid anything around you. Where it's a lot different is when you're getting on and off the plane, because those same ventilation things are often not turned on, and you're like exerting yourself more and pulling down luggage from places and breathing harder. And I think those are the times actually that if you are going to mask, that probably makes more sense during those periods than when you're just sitting back relaxed in your seat. Well, going on our list, my prediction for last year, and this was in the wake of Facebook rebranding its company as Meta, which did happen in 2021. I predicted this year that someone you know will purchase and talk endlessly about their new VR headset. And obviously, there are a number of companies that are going into the virtual reality world. Facebook's product is probably the most ubiquitous at the moment. But I'll be honest with you, and this is probably just speak to the people I see and hang out with, but I was, this summer we were invited to somebody's, like, they bought a new house. It was an open house, and there was a kid there who was probably 10 who had on one of those Oculus headsets doing what with, I don't know, but seemed to be enjoying himself. That's like the only one I've seen out in the wild. So to say, I guess that kind of qualifies that somebody I sort of know who has a kid who I met once was using one is about the extent of this. And from the people who are a lot smarter about this than me seem to think that although an amazing amount of money, especially in Meta, is being poured into this technology, we're a little more than a couple of years away from this being something that's capturing a lot of people's attention. Have you two seen it much around your circles?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I mean, I talked to quite a few college students about, you know, what they're doing as far as their hobbies and things. That's not really, doesn't come anywhere near the top of the things that they're doing in the free time that they have. I've, you know, got family members. It's just not a matter of discussion. And I guess I'm not too surprised. You know, one of the things that at this point in our kind of cultural history coming out of the pandemic, so many people are looking for activities that will bring them together more. And that's an, you know, this is an individual kind of isolating thing, you know, like you do on your own. So it might be that it really came out and got marketed at the wrong time, given that we were coming out of a pandemic, the mask mandates are ending, people are being more sociable, and they're advertising something that would have been perfect 2 years earlier.
I think, I mean, between the three of us, I'm the only one that I'm presuming actually owns an Oculus Quest.
Oh, well, then this is great. Okay. So
but
we want to hear from you.
I mean, the reason why I own it is because my brother sent it to me because he works for Meta, and he's doing, you know, technical design work for, you know, some far flung. He's not working with that with the Oculus stuff specifically, but I have it. I've used it. I enjoy it. But I think, Rick, you're absolutely right that it is such a solitary thing because you are putting yourself in this singular world, which is, you know, good and bad. And it's also, I mean, it's something that you have to put on and take off, and you can't easily switch from playing the game and then, or, you know, viewing the whatever, interacting with whatever it is you're doing into, you know, going and making a sandwich in the way that you would if you were just playing a normal video game on your TV, where you can just hit pause, put the controller down, go do the sandwich and come back, or, you know, just have the conversation with whoever just came in, you know, while you're still doing the thing. And part of the problem that I've had with it is just putting it on is an investment. It is something where if I'm going to go to the trouble to put myself in a place where I have the room to move around and, you know, whatever, then it's like, I'm going to commit an hour. It's not a, you know, pick it up and put it down kind of thing. So I enjoy it for what it is, but I'm also not a huge gamer in the first place. So maybe it's not for me. One of the best uses I think I've found for it so far is just, you know, watching Netflix. So, you know, it's certainly has its applications.
But Rick had mentioned, you both said that it's maybe the timing's not quite right because people are looking to do things with others. But isn't one of its selling points is that you have the ability to interact with other people out in the metaverse? And is that something that you've done much? And I mean, what I've heard, again, I've not done this, so I'm just kind of hearing things secondhand. But the two things I've heard is that, one, it's a lot of kids, a lot of young people. I mean, you know, sometimes, you know, kids or maybe early 20s. And two, there's in that group of people, there are some people who are just awkward. And then there's also a subset that are kind of creepy. And I don't know if that matches what you've seen in your experience.
My usage of it has been pretty walled off little garden. I basically have used it to interact with my brother and, you know, just kind of catch up with him while we play a round of weird mini golf, which is a lot of fun. But I have not really plumbed the depths that are out there. So,
well, I think we can chalk up that prediction of mine is probably mostly not true. However, and I've been looking forward to this, we're going to go to Chris's next prediction. And I'm going to read the prediction because he makes two predictions in one sentence. And I think we can say that both were absolutely not true.
Very quantifiably wrong, but yeah. The other is.
No, this is definitely the big loser of the bunch.
It is. So his prediction, the two predictions in one sentence are: the Oscars will be boring, and West Side Story will win Best Picture. So we will remind people that you do co-host a entertainment-based podcast here on the Lee Enterprise Podcast Network. So we figured that you would do a better job than this, but let's just unpack these one at a time.
Yeah.
Oscars will be boring. How did that turn out?
Well, I mean, the actual awards that were given out, in my defense, were boring. Coda, which won Best Picture, Children of Deaf Adults, which folks can watch on Apple Plus. Very good film that won Best Picture. It won Best Supporting Actor. But obviously...
Yeah, but that's not what people talk about, I don't think.
Exactly. Nobody talks about that. But the slap is, you know, which we're still talking about as there's a new Will Smith movie that's coming out. It's not even really worth getting into the nitty gritty of it, but yeah, Will Smith, you know, open hand slapped Chris Rock on the stage after Chris Rock made a joke about Will Smith's wife's hair. So, yeah, it was certainly not boring, but in a way that could never have been predicted. You know, there weren't any, Vegas prop bets about that. But, you know, there will be now.
So. It was fun. I was not watching the Oscars, but I was on, I think I was on Twitter when the news broke and I saw the news. I mean, maybe minutes after it happened, and there was like debate right away. Was this just like a gimmick? Was this just sort of a setup thing? But then you watch it and you're like, no, it wasn't. And it certainly wasn't boring. And of course, folks who listen to this podcast may remember that was actually a topic of a show Rick and I did about people's reactions to that. And it was somewhat telling to see those who defended Will Smith and those who, in my opinion, rightly defended Chris Rock. And it was interesting. And again, it also kind of goes back to the canceled piece we talked about earlier. There were some discussions in the weeks and months after that incident, whether this film on Apple TV Plus would even come out and how that Apple would try to market this, because was Will Smith such a toxic figure that no one would want to watch? And I probably the answer right now is too early to tell, but it's been interesting.
And the movie that you're mentioning that came out this year that he's most likely going to, I think it's on the bubble whether or not he's going to get a nomination for the Oscars.
He could.
He, I think he could.
But he can't be there to take it.
No, he can't be there to take it. But he could still win. He just, you know, won't actually be in the room. But based on the reviews that Emancipation is getting, it doesn't sound, I mean, it sounds like it's a fine film, but again, loaded with everything that was, you know, the year for Will Smith, everything that's happened since the Oscars. It's yeah. Plus the movie just not performing very well. Yeah. I don't think he's going to be in the running. And I mean, honestly, it was a lot more fun to talk about this back in April, you know? And I mean, it's, you know, at this point, I'd much rather yeah.
Well, and just to take the second part of your prediction, you said West Side Story would win Best Picture. You, of course, folks know that did happen. Coda did. We'll tease to next week's show, where you make more Oscar predictions in our next episode of The Ethical Life. But why? What would were you
glutton for punishment right here? Glutton for punishment.
Why were you surprised? I mean, there was a bit of time passed between when we recorded and when the Oscars. That's in February, is that right?
It normally is in February. I think it got pushed further back than that because of pandemic stuff. It might have even been in April, actually. March or April.
Were you surprised though, by the time the Oscar ceremony happened, that West Side Story did it peak too early, or what were your thoughts?
I think it didn't necessarily peak too early. It came out towards the end of the year, and at that point in time, people were still very iffy about going to theaters. And it ended up on HBO Max, I think sometime around Christmas or early January, maybe. It won Best Picture Musical or Comedy from the Golden Globes. It got Best Actress Musical or Comedy. It got Best Supporting Actress. And it did win Best Supporting Actress, the Oscar for Ariana DeBose. And I think even when we recorded, there was a certain amount of me having a lot of just wishful thinking, because West Side Story is still absolutely fantastic. There are so many just gorgeous things in that film, and the retelling of that story. I'm still just, you know, knocked over by it. But so I don't know. I never would have predicted that Coda would have won. I think that's, there, you know, I think there were some certain, not to diminish that film, but I think there was a lot of, you know, things that got split, a lot of, you know, things that kind of canceled each other out in the voting process. So, yeah, that's West Side Story. If you haven't seen it, go see it. That's my take.
Well, we are to our final prediction of this year, and it was Rick's. And I think at the time, we thought it was probably the most provocative of the predictions for last year. Rick, what did you say?
Well, I predicted that Liz Cheney would emerge as a major political presence with more influence than Donald Trump. And I put it out there mainly just to be provocative. And I found it really interesting to see like what actually transpired. My impression is, and this is, of course, it's controversial because we're in a country now that is so polarized with their attitudes. But I think that Liz Cheney's role as vice chair on the January 6th committee brought credibility and a kind of moral gravitas to the committee that, for example, the two impeachment attempts that were run pretty much just on a partisan basis did not have. And then after losing her primary, she formed a PAC, a new political action committee, that ran ads against Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham in Arizona. And, you know, given the really narrow margin that Carrie Lake lost by, you'd think that like that may have been, you know, like the straw that broke the camel's back there. But we also know that, you know, following the analysis of what happened in the 2022 election, that President Trump's endorsement probably hurt candidates more than helped them. And so I think it's probably true that, you know, like, even though there, you know, you don't have a huge number of people that are, you know, pushing Liz Cheney to run for president or do something like that, like, in some ways, her influence right now is greater, given the political context, than Trump's.
But it's important to insert here that she is about to become a former member of Congress, and that's because she lost a primary in a very conservative state in Wyoming. And I think there's everyone would agree that the reason she lost that primary was because of her actions around the January 6th committee and some of the other positions she took very strongly against then President Trump and now former President Trump. And I think she has said pretty straightforward that even though she will soon no longer be a member of Congress, the number one thing that she is going to work to do over the next, well, however long it takes, is to make sure Donald Trump is not elected president again. And that is sort of her, and whether it's her running or whether she supports people who are going to defeat him, whether Donald Trump makes enough mistakes along the way that he no longer is a viable candidate, all those things are open to question. But it's not like her political power is greater. I mean, there were people who 2, 3, 4 years ago were saying that she might be the next Speaker of the House. And, well, that is not going to happen. So it is important to point out that although her influence may have grown, her true political power has greatly diminished.
No, I think that it's the, like, she, of course, she doesn't have the same kind of political influence as a representative of Wyoming anymore, but I think she has more influence as a national political figure, unifying people around ideas. She's kind of like Obi-Wan Kenobi, who becomes more powerful after being killed by Darth Vader.
Yeah. And I mean, I think ideas, yes, but principles more so. And that's the thing. It was more about, like, it seems like she was the one out there saying, you know, this isn't my Republican Party anymore, to, you know, obviously very roughly paraphrase, and say it in a way that, you know, had a lot more strength behind it, I guess. I mean, if not, you know, name brand, you know, value. So
Rick, how would you grade your prediction there?
I think it's true. I think the force is with her.
Well, that
we're gonna see some Liz Cheney for Ron DeSantis ads out there.
Well, and it's important. I mean, it's important to remind people too, though, that, you know, Liz Cheney could not be more clear about her opinion of Donald Trump. At the same time, Liz Cheney could not be more clear about her conservative principles. And I mean, I know there were people saying, oh, we should have some unity ticket that's like, I don't know, maybe not Joe Biden, but maybe Joe Biden and Liz Cheney. Wouldn't that be great for America? Well, my goodness, there are, if you set aside the nonsense around Trump and the election denying stuff, Liz Cheney, you know, is still a very traditional Republican in all the ways we used to look at them. And I think it's just been interesting that there are people who think that, gosh, wouldn't she make a great president? And perhaps she would. But remember that, you know, not only is she a conservative Republican, she voted in agreement with Donald Trump or bills he signed nearly all the time. So I guess I just say that because I think sometimes people get too wrapped around the axle on the election piece and think that Liz Cheney is just one of them. And again, I'm not going to pick sides here, but to say that there's little political difference between her and Democrats could not be further from the truth.
And I think that's really, in many ways, the source of her influence right now. I think if she was perceived as somebody who is actually more Democratic leaning than the typical Republican, then she wouldn't have the credibility on the January 6th committee that she does. It's because she is a conservative Republican that she can take the position she does and have some credibility among, I would say, like the centrist Democrats and centrist Republicans.
And her last name certainly helps.
Yeah. But there's no path for her to have a credible run for the presidency. I just don't see that.
But you think she could have a credible chance of making sure that Donald J. Trump is not elected again?
Yeah, because we saw especially what happened in Georgia, the way that so many people who are moderates, I mean, they voted for Brian Kemp, but against Herschel Walker. And so you saw that, like, this is a real shift. Like that's not a majority of voters, but at a time where you have these huge polarization, you've got a lot of people that you know are voting straight tickets. You don't need a huge shift to make a big difference in the outcomes of elections. And this is why I think that she has so much influence, that she's a person who is able to speak to those voters who might shift from one party to another in crucial races. And there's very few politicians out there right now who can do that, who people like that will listen to.
Well, I think we will have to leave it there. But guys, this has been fun. Thanks for making time to do this. And thanks for reviewing what we said a year ago. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite and Chris Lay, I'm Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in next week when we foolishly make our predictions for 2023.